Hello and welcome to The Improverbial, a podcast where we unearth obscure sayings and phrases from around the world, invent absurd new proverbs, and talk about things mundane, spurious, irrelevant, and profound. I am the Habitalist, Pete Kirkwood.
And I'm Lisa Thauvet, the Tilt Thinker. I've been doing and coaching improv for many years. Pete and I have been doing improv together for some of those years. This podcast is a mashup of Pete's interest in the science of well-being, my background in education and human development, our shared fascination with the world's idiomatic weirdness, and our superpowers in improv comedy. We are the Improv-verbializers.
Woohoo!
Yeah!
Okay, hey. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Improv-verbial. Our proverb for today is to put a spanner in the works. I had a couple false starts today in recording this, and someone must have thrown a spanner in my works, as it were. Okay, so there's multiple versions of this saying. In the United States, we often say to throw a wrench in the works or to throw a monkey wrench in the works. But it's no mystery. In England, they call a wrench a spanner. So it's called a spanner in the works, as we say in England, in jolly old England. So what does it mean? Collins Dictionary says when someone throws a spanner in the works, they prevent something happening smoothly in the way that it was planned by causing a problem or difficulty. Merriam-Webster just says to cause something to not go as planned. So, you know, like imagine some kind of intricate machine with like drive shafts and cog teeth and tie rods and flywheels. It's just humming along, minding its own business. And then imagine chucking like a giant wrench in the middle of it and see what happens.
It would mess it up, Pete.
Mess it up. Mm-hmm. That is so, yeah, it's not, this one's not particularly difficult to perceive.
Right. But you can imagine that would cause a problem. And that's what happens when you use this word. Something's happened. That's messed things up.
Messed it up. So did you look into what, any interesting trivia about this one?
Yeah, I did. I'm sure you ran across similar things that I saw that it's not surprisingly looks like it's from the industrial age where there were mechanical things happening and that there's a Luddite.
Luddite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A Luddite type of association.
Oh, I got a bunch of stuff on
a
that.
A Luddite being someone who is not a fan of technology. Looks like there was an individual named Ned Ludd.
There was not.
You say that is a false story that I was about to bring
Well, forth. we'll get to that. I wanted to just really quick get to the etymology of this, where it originated. Yeah. So the British version, the spanner in the works, came from P.G. Woodhouse in Right Ho Jeeves. I love Woodhouse. I don't know if you're familiar, but hilarious stuff. All that sort of English butler as hero stuff.
Okay, yes.
That's where it originated. but there was the American version to throw a wrench in the works was earlier. It was in the Chicago. Did I say 1934? Right Ho Jeeves?
No, you didn't say that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Chicago Tribune had it in 1907, the 30th of July. And it said, this is a little bit funny because it says it should look to them as if he were throwing a monkey wrench into the only market by visiting that Cincinnati circus upon the devoted heads of Kentucky's best customers. Don't ask me what that means. But what's interesting is that it suggests an even earlier origin than 1907 because they didn't even use the whole phrase. The whole phrase being to throw a wrench into the works. They said by throwing a monkey wrench into the market. So that to me implies that the reader would have already recognized this expression as you needing the works part to make sense. And they threw, they kind of dropped that as a shorthand. So in any case, I think that, it's at least 1907, potentially earlier in at least in the United States. It seems to have risen out of the Luddites, like you said. And nowadays, to be called a Luddite has kind of a derogatory, small-minded, anti-progress type of a connotation. But the original Luddites were craftspeople, mainly in textiles, in the early 1800s, like you said, right around the time that the Industrial Revolution started coming along. They were worried about mechanization, destroying their jobs, and making them obsolete. So they went about monkey wrenching the machines as a form of protest. So we figure if we could break these machines, then we could keep our jobs more or less.
Right. Get rid of the machines. Then for sure, they're going to let us keep working here.
Right. The Luddites were named after someone named Ned Ludd, who was supposedly a weaver from Leicester in England. However, that is made up.
That's not true. Okay.
No, there's a whole bunch of the his name is drawn from a whole bunch of kind of Welsh and English mythology. Okay. And he was kind of like a fictional character made up as a sort of embodiment of this movement.
Maybe like a Paul Bunyan or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Was Paul Bunyan a fake guy too?
Let's say he is.
Oh, yeah. Fake Paul Bunyan. This uprising of the kind of crafts, the artisan craftspeople against the rise of the machines, was eventually put down by the mill owners and the British government and the military. And, you know, they even like shot protesters and stuff like that. So the Luddites were cleared out of the way and the Industrial Revolution sped on apace.
Mm-hmm. And it seemed to work. I mean, we don't have any technology really. I mean, no, machines have gone away and it's all handcrafted now.
Wait, this part of the podcast is true.
Oh, wait. Oh gosh. Look at that.
Save that made up stuff for later. But yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that struggle between kind of automation and sort of craftsmanship or something.
Yeah.
It goes on, and the battle of humans versus the machines is an ongoing one that has, we are not done with that struggle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that where you went with this, thinking about this?
Well, I mean, a little bit of that really to oppose technology, you know, if there's better productivity and if it makes life quote unquote easier, then it does seem to march forward. And, you know, I thought of this proverb as this idea of like this disruption of something that's working, you're throwing a wrench in it. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of went down the path of this idea of disruptors. Sometimes in education, we talk about some children have a tendency of being a disruptor. Uh-huh. And you know, you can think of that, oh, it's disrupting, like kind of from the adult perspective, oh, you disrupted my lesson or class. My whole plan. But on a more child-centered viewpoint of it there are children in the classroom that have an urge to disrupt, as in, you know, if I'm walking through the classroom and I'm a disruptor, I just walk by and I kind of shift your paper a little bit. And that is a kind of a tendency in some people.
And now, is that a good thing you're saying?
Well, no, I think it's just something to recognize. There is that tendency out there. And of course, you know, as somebody's
doesn't that seem like a tendency in all people? Well, some people are better at not actually doing
exactly
the thing.
That's exactly it. Right. Exactly. In childhood, it's much more pronounced. Uh-huh. It's when I say childhood, I mean, that's just the future adult. Right. So it's helping that child to recognize, oh, you're interrupting, you know,
like whenever I see a mime that's like balanced on one foot, I want to just push him a little bit.
Push him just with that.
But do I
finger.
Do it?
No, you hold yourself back.
Well, not usually.
The impulsivity gets tapered a bit as we age. Now, this is a negative connotation, of course, in education, but in the business world, a disruptor, that's the new buzzword in Silicon Valley.
Oh, Elon Musk is a disruptor.
We got Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Steve Jobs. They disrupted an industry. They have they've created something entirely new and redefined.
Ironically, they did it by making things even more robotically automated.
Well, that is exactly where I went, that this idea that the people who are against technology were trying to cause disruption of this trend where now the new disruptors are the ones who are leading the charge in technology.
So who's right?
Who's right, Pete?
Yeah.
So I think time will tell.
Is it like the government and the owners and the military on the side of automation and efficiency, or is it the artisan laborers like on the side of craft and skill and tradition? I mean, mechanization has definitely led to incredible advances in cheapness and comfort and safety and stuff. I mean, I'm reminded of the scene where John Cleese is in the amphitheater saying, you know, what have the Romans done for us? And then his friends are all listing, well, they did bring the roads and the sewer systems and the drinking water and the freedom from disease and law and order. And he's like, but other than that, what have the Romans done for us? So the point being, like, some great things have come out of this kind of progress, right? But like, I think there's a great case to be made for inefficiency in terms of quality of life, right?
Right. Yep. And we look at quality of life. We've talked about this before on the podcast, this idea of if you and I want to find out a fact somewhere, we could easily whip out our phone and find exactly the answer to that.
But instead, we just make it up.
We make it up. Yeah, we make it up here. But there is something about just sitting in this idea. We don't, you and I didn't come up with it out of our own noggins.
Yeah.
And we're just going to sit with that non-knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's exactly. just fine. And if it really was important to us, maybe later I'll go and I will look it up. And that just proves I sustain the thought. I sustain the curiosity. And now I'm going to find the answer. I can find the answer. I don't have to go through microfiche to find it. That's nice.
Right.
But to find it on the spot and for us to lose our eye contact and to lose our flow to go onto a device, I don't know how that helps our quality of life.
Yeah. And that by the same token, like which is the world that you find most appealing? One farmer farming thousands of acres on a sort of remote controlled GPS enabled combine harvester, or like a bunch of Amish people in the field threshing together? I get like we need food for everybody, right? But like, I don't know, you know, I mean, why is it that we're so fascinated with like, you know, urban chicken coops and like people making, you know, I don't know, like craft fairs. Because we harken back to that. There's something human about that scale and about that pace. And there's something humanizing about engaging in those behavior, in those practices, right? That I think is really lost with the.
Well, I can tell you, Pete, I would much rather do this podcast with you here live in the flesh. I see all of your inadequacies and all your flaws. They're just screaming at me.
And your gigantic glasses.
And my huge glasses I have on my face because of my inadequate vision. But I would rather that any day than the animatronic Pete Kirkwood. Here we are, Pete, in our second part of our episode. This is such a fun part because we're making all of this up. I mean, screw all those facts. Like, I don't have to do any research for this one. Mm-hmm. I show up with an open brain, an uncaffeinated brain. I don't know about you, Pete.
Oh, I'm caffeinated.
You're totally caffeinated. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how we get there. We're going to make up all this next part. We make up the proverb and we make up the etymology.
It's all fake.
It's all fake. So speaking of fake, why don't we go over here to our proverbatron and get a couple of words. Now, Pete, I'll tell you, I'm so glad the proverbatron is up and running because some Luddite was in here and threw a monkey wrench right at our machine. God, but you know that steel casing you installed last past weekend?
Yeah, that electromagnetic steel casing.
Yeah, the wrench clang onto the side.
Yeah.
And alerted
the night watchman.
The night watchman came around and that Luddite is now in the stockades. The stocks right now. And
that's
we'll
where we
be
keep
throwing,
our Luddites.
Throwing some tomatoes at them later. Yeah. We won't say their name, but So why don't we get this thing started?
Let's get the show on the road.
Woohoo. All right, Pete, you want to go ahead and push the button on the proverbatron to get our first word?
Succulent.
And the first word is succulent.
Succulent. Pete.
I know. It's not even a naughty word.
It sounds
just
so
sounds
dirty.
So naughty. It does. I love it. Well, I'm so psyched that came out.
Let's see what our second word. Let's see if it's as naughty as that one.
Yeah.
Here I go. I'll push the button.
Let me help you here. Let me help you with this part, Lisa.
There we go.
Oh, there you go. Ready?
Here we go.
Foam.
Oh, I dare say that's just as naughty as succulent.
Foam. No, I say succulent slightly naughtier.
Really?
Foam, but maybe not.
Oh, I don't know your experience with the foam, Pete.
I can't wait. Well, I love this one because it's a literary reference. And I love how much I love that stuff. And interestingly enough, it comes from Woodhouse, the English author from the 30s. And the saying is, oh, succulent foam, oh, sweet disaster.
Oh, succulent foam, oh, sweet disaster.
Oh, succulent foam, oh, sweet disaster.
Pete, this is, as you said, this is such a great one. And this literary reference, I know you did some research on this.
Yeah, and I know that you're familiar with this one too. Virginia's Folly, which is a famous Woodhouse novel from 1934. It's a great, hilarious example of genre because it is transitional from the kind of lighthearted and sort of mannerly English novels of the time to a more modern genre, which is like kind of like the romance novel. It starts to get a little steamy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And where it takes that turn, right, is when Virginia happens into the pantry and mm-hmm. comes upon the man who will become her lover mm-hmm. and says, what does she say?
She says, oh, succulent foam, oh, sweet disaster. Yeah.
So, and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, what, ho, Jeeves.
Yeah, you did not expect it at all. And I mean, the movie version of this is really quite scandalous. I mean, absolutely. This was the first time that I think it was the first NC-17 rating was from this film.
Well, that was even before they even had those ratings, they but didn't like even it would have been, it was racy.
No, my research shows this was, they created NC-17 for the film. Virginia's Folly was the book version. Yep, yep. The film version was Virginia Gets Off Easy. And that, you know, you just
say
think,
no more. I mean, yeah. You know where we're going here with this.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, succulent foam, oh, sweet disaster. So Virginia is the lady of the house. She's a young, just in case those of you, the few people that wouldn't have read this one, mm-hmm. she is a widow. She's a young widow. What shall we say? She was fiery, passionate, but her husband, a sea captain, a young sea captain, on his first voyage after their marriage, was dashed upon the rocks. Mm-hmm. So now she has this big manor house.
Yeah,
all this help,
all alone, and help mm-hmm. around the kitchen, right?
Yep. Help around,
and
the kitchen.
She needed some other kind of help. She couldn't just reach the larder that was at the top mm-mm. of the pantry. Mm-mm. She needed other help.
Yeah, she had to have Edmund help her. Edmund.
Yeah.
The muscular. He keeps describing Edmund as muscular.
He had so many adjectives for Virginia, mm-hmm. but he just had one adjective for Edmund.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was muscular.
Which is, you know, amazing because, you know, we call Virginia things like voluptuous and passionate and
the variation that he would have, and this was not of the time, was he would always spell muscular different. So he'd have the muscular with a C, but sometimes it with a K. Yeah. Sometimes it's L E R at the mm-hmm. end. Sometimes L U R.
He did take some liberties with that. So one of the tasks that Virginia would have Edmund do is, there's a thing that they have in England. It's royal jelly. Are you familiar with royal jelly? It's a bee product, but it's a sweet product. And she would like to see Edmund like working hard at things. Yeah. So she would have him whip the royal jelly into like a foam.
Yeah, right? Into a foam.
So that famous scene is he's got his shirt off because it's muscular work. It's hot work in that scullery. And there he is whipping the royal jelly into foam.
Yes.
And then disaster.
Then disaster strikes. I mean, do we want to roll a clip from the movie version?
Sure. Yeah.
Taylor, you got that in cue? Hello, Edmund. Fine day outside.
Hello, my lady.
I'm wondering how that roy jelly's going.
I'm very slowly, my lady. I'm stirring with all my strength, as you can see here.
Edmund, you know I need the royal jelly for the guests coming tonight.
Well, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I shall stir much faster. I shall stir very, very quickly indeed. I shall stir it until...
Edmund.
Yes, ma'am.
It seems that you're working up a sweat.
Yes, I am.
I would imagine you would be more comfortable if you had less clothing covering you.
Yes, ma'am. If with your blessing, I shall remove my smock.
You have my blessing, Edmund.
Right, then, thank you.
Oh, Edmund.
I'm stirring now. I've got to back to the stirring, ma'am. Stirring very rapidly.
Is it quite foamy?
It's rather foamy, yes. Yes, indeed. Oh, my goodness. It's gone out of control. Oh, I'm about to fall off the ladder.
Oh, Edmund. Oh, dear. Oh, Edmund. Oh, succulent foam. Oh, sweet disaster.
And there you have it. That's the quote.
Taylor, thank you. You got the cue perfectly. Well done.
So hot and steamy. I'm feeling a little hot under the collar just watching that.
I know, we got to watch it. I mean, folks at home, you can imagine what we're seeing. Right. Let me say, the actor playing Edmund, unknown actor, it's Sigmund Flangrant.
It's a Flangrant
because he's from the south of France. And he is quite a specimen. And now, Pete, I'm going to use several adjectives because muscular.
Because muscular doesn't do him justice.
No, he is vibrant. He is horse-like. Is that?
A bit horsey.
Horse-like, but.
But in a hot way, like in the way that like a stallion is horse-like.
Or like a horse that. I'm sorry, I have to spell this out to you.
Sorry, can you explain?
Spell this out to you. Yeah. Women, you know what I'm talking about. He's horse-like in that film version,
like, you start to see what Lisa means by that. So, I mean, I think you can get this on YouTube.
Maybe not. I mean, you have to probably say you're over 18 in order to see it.
But folks, suffice to say, it's the beginning of a whole new genre of both literature at that time and also film at later days. And just to kind of close that circle, you know, now when this is what people, it's an exclamation which is used when you feel that things have just, that by means of some sort of sudden thing happening, everything has suddenly shifted. You say, oh, succulent foam.
Oh, sweet disaster.